Hello, and welcome to the Locus Roundtable Podcast. Today, we're podcasting with two authors from Nightshade Publishers, an excellent lineup of debut authors in 2011. First up, we have Stina Light, who is the author of Blood and Honey. Stina, if you could say hello.
Hello, everybody from Austin, Texas.
And we're also podcasting today with Teresa Frohawk, who is the author of Miserere. Teresa, if you could say hello.
Hello.
Wonderful. Thank you. Stina, I wonder if you could start out talking a little bit about your experience, as a newly published author last year.
It's been fantastic in so many ways. It's ridiculous, but it's been also been kind of a roller coaster ride. So there have been ups and downs. A majority of it has been... You have certain expectations as a beginning writer as what this whole process is going to be like. And some of it actually met my expectations. A lot of it exceeded my expectations because it's been so much better than I actually envisioned. My book did so much better than I thought it would. Because it is such a very specific topic, that Northern Ireland and all. And then at the same time, there were many things about it that were disappointing as well, because you have these outlandish ideas of what it's going to be like to be an author. One amongst them is also that all your troubles are over with once the book is published. When that isn't true at all, actually your troubles kind of compound because there's even more pressure. You know, however good your first book is, your second book, trying to meet the expectation of it and beating that first book is there, and it's kind of a struggle. It feels like, I don't know, you're so happy and you're on top of the world, but at the same time you're also kind of depressed and you can't figure out why. And no one can tell you why unless it's someone who's also been through it. So it's kind of weird and neat, and just thank God for people who've been through it.
And Teresa, how have you found your experience?
It was just crazy from the get-go. Part of it is because of working a full-time job and then writing in the evening, so my production rate is not what you would call fabulous at times. You know, by the time I usually get to work, it's about 7 in the evening here, 7:30, and I try and work at least until 11. But some nights, you know, I was pulling hours until midnight, and it was so difficult trying to work on Miserere at the same time as trying to start a new novel. And there was a lot of research involved in both Miserere and in my current work in progress, because I thought it would be really easy to find sources, and found out it is not. So I was spending a lot of time reading, taking notes, working on Miserere, and about the time I would start to get into the new novel, here would come more edits or marketing or something else. And I mean, it was just insane. And I thought, you know, I should be able to just, you know, start a second novel. I worked so long on Miserere. I worked 2 years on it. I bled over that novel some nights, trying to edit out words that shouldn't be there or what should be there, and how to tighten it up and put the focus where it needed to be, and how to keep it from being perceived as a religious novel. And we'll probably talk about that later too. That was one of the disappointments, how it keeps popping up as a religious novel. You know, it's just, I don't know what to do to people to get them to see that, other than, you know, just give it a shot. But it's just so funny at times, and that's been some of the disappointment, some of the reactions to it. But I was reading, you know, I could not get myself focused on another novel. It was so hard because I was so scared I would never write anything again. I kept thinking of those, yeah. You remember those bands from the 70s and the 80s, and they play like one hit and then you never hear from them again? And I kept having that same scenario play through my mind. And
yeah, exactly. That one hit wonder.
It was frightening. It was terrifying. And I don't think people realize how it just, you know, it just locked my brain up completely. And I have the most wonderful agent. I mean, she talked me through some of it, you know, and I can always call her and talk to Veronica when I need to. But still, it was just insanity, it felt to me, because all these blogs on how to write and how to get published and how to get an agent never take you beyond that point of what the heck do you do once you got published and you have where do you go from there?
Absolutely. It's like the fish from Finding Nemo. That's the name of the film. Finding Nemo, you know, the one that's all like, you know, keep on swimming, keep swimming, keep swimming, swimming, swimming. You have to keep riding. But that's the thing. It's terrifying. It's just as scary. You know, it's just nobody tells you that.
Keep on swimming. And even though sometimes it feels like you're doing, you know, the dog paddle in the whirlpool or something, you just keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Keep your head above water. And just the tension from all of that and then working. And, you know, and then you're watching Amazon rankings and your blood pressure's going up and down by Amazon rankings. My poor husband, one day he said, honey, we're going to have to talk. And I don't blame him. I was crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. You feel crazy. You really do. I do have to put in a good word for Joe Monty, my agent. I'm lucky enough that I get to meet him a couple of times a year, and I have soaked the front of his shirt with tears more times than I care to count. It's just that and my own husband who's bless Dane. Oh my God. I think husbands of first novelists or spouses of first novelists should get some sort of a medal, frankly. All the shit they put up with.
So let's back up for a second and talk a little bit about that first step. How long did it take each of you to actually go through the manuscript to agent to publishers?
I started writing it. Well, the research for Miserere really started when it started a long time ago, because I've just always been interested in religion and how the different religions work together or not. And so I had a college course that I had to take. It was a mandatory course, and it was in the Old Testament. And I just loved the instructor. He came in and he said, this is not Sunday school. We're going to be talking about this as a form of literature, and we're going to be talking about it as a history. And, I mean, he just went on and on, and he just drew out so many interesting facts that I had never seen before, because I always got it in snippets, just a little here, a little there. You know how you get it, you know, a little from the TV. If you're watching a Republican debate tonight, I'm sure you're getting some. I mean, it's just, you know, that kind of censored type view on religion, and it was usually very biased and very wrong and incorrect, not just in the theology, but incorrect in quoting just little bits and pieces and taking it out of context. And that was something that always bothered me. So the more we read through the book and studied it for what it was meant to be, which is generally a history in the first part of the Old Testament, we got to the Psalms. And I thought, you know, they're almost like spells. I mean, it was so cool. There were psalms for healing and psalms for this. And, I mean, they had, you know, different things. And the more I got into it, I started reading things. And here you get to hear me mispronounce a word like the Old Testament pseudepigraphia. And I started looking into Gnostic Christianity. And, I mean, it was just like this whole new world had opened up to me. And I thought, gee, why has nobody ever done this before? Well, now I know. People see Christian and their brain just shuts off, and they never take it that extra step. And I know, and I'm not saying it, it to be ugly or to blame anybody, because I used to have the same prejudices. I really did. But what I wanted, though, was not a novel about religion. And this is where it got real tricky with Miserere. I wanted a novel about tolerance, and I wanted a novel about redemption. And I wanted those two topics in there. And someone had posted a book review online and asked a very, very good question recently as to why I didn't mix the religions together to have one, you know, almost like a conglomeration of religions. And I thought, when I was writing Miserere, I thought about doing that, and I thought, yes, but that would take away everything that is unique and special about each one of these religions. And they all do. They're the same in some ways, but in other ways they have very unique and very beautiful practices, Hinduism and Buddhism, I mean, all of them. And to me, it's just always seemed like such a, I don't know, it's just such a beautiful thing. It really is, the way people can come together and how it draws people together as a community. But what really got me was when I was reading the Dead Sea Scrolls, had just recently been translated, and there was a, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, an Essene community, and one of the scrolls was the War Scroll, and it talked about the sons of light defeating the sons of darkness. And I thought, well, gee, you know, if you can have sons of darkness, you can have daughters of darkness, and you can have daughters of light, and we can mix them all together, and that'd be pretty kind of cool, you know? and from there, it just kind of took off. And so when I was in the Old Testament class, and they were talking about the veil that separated the Ark of the Covenant and separated God from man's eyes, you know, I kept thinking, wow, gee, a veil, that's it, that's what I need is a veil. So much for my religious upbringing right there. So I was raised in an independent Baptist church, okay? And so everybody was talking about, you know, demons and hell and everything. They had my interest. And then after that, I always thought, gee, heaven sounds kind of boring. I mean, all you do is you just kind of stand around and sing a lot. But hell was a really happening place.
That's where all the interesting people went.
Oh, God. So, anyway, that was how all the conceptions for Miserere came about. And putting it all together took me 2 years. I wrote a rough draft, and I thought, my God, this is just the most wonderful novel in the world. And then I put it on the online writing workshop, and I don't know, 8-10 people told me what, it really sucked. Oh, they couldn't be right. And I cried, and I thought, I'm never going to do this again. And then this is the illness I think Stina was talking about earlier, is you get up the next day and say, oh, I can fix it. It's like an addict, you know. I can fix it. So I did, and I ended up rewriting the whole bloody thing. As a matter of fact, I think I kept maybe 2 or 3 scenes out of the whole thing, and even they wound up dramatically changed. And I'm beginning to think that's just what I have to do. I just have to go through that pain of writing a first draft and then go back through and change it, just so even though I do a synopsis and everything, and everything came out that I had in my synopsis, it came out differently than I first imagined it. And that's where the characters just take over for me. You know, once I have them, man, I've got it, you know, because I know what they're going to do. But it's not always an easy process to go through.
Okay, so it sounds like both of you have novels that might, on first blush, have seemed like a hard sell. How did the whole agent to publisher road go, Stina?
Okay, for me, again, I started off, I had the idea, came originally to me was actually a short story set in Austin, and one of the characters was Irish. And I published that short story, and Charles DeLint read it, long story short, and he asked me where the rest of it was, and I said it was in my head, and he said, that's wrong answer. So, so I had to sit around and think about the rest of the story. And meanwhile, in another part of the forest, I started reading this book called Those Are Real Bullets by Peter Pringle, I think it is. Philip Pringle? Darn it, I don't have the book right in front of me, and I really should. Anyway, it's called Those Are Real Bullets, and it's about Bloody Sunday. At the time, I thought it would be about soldiers, because I was doing a lot of research about soldiers for another novel I was writing, and ended up abandoning for a short while. And as it turned out, it was about Bloody Sunday in 1971, or in January, and in Northern Ireland. And the more I read, the more horrified I was. It's an eyewitness account written by two British reporters who happened to be in Londonderry/Derry at the time when the British troops, the paratroopers, fired on and killed 13 unarmed civilians. And they were just there protesting for, they were protesting for civil rights, and they wanted to be able to vote, they wanted good housing, they wanted to be able to get jobs. The unemployment rate among Catholic nationalist men was astronomical. I want to say somewhere upwards around 65%. It may have been more. I can't remember the exact figures, but it was insane. It was insane. Nothing like we've seen here. But at the same time, I saw a lot of similarities between that and what was the tensions that were growing between liberals and conservatives here in the United States. And I was horrified, just totally horrified. And I thought, why should we be we shouldn't be repeating mistakes, the mistakes the British made. We should be learning from them. So my goal when I started writing was to, I thought maybe five of my friends might read this thing. I never imagined that anyone in Ireland would ever pick it up. So I did a lot of research. It took me about three years to go and do all of the reading that it took just to get comfortable to write a few scenes, because originally the novel was mostly in Austin, Texas, and then I did all these flashbacks in the main character. He wasn't even a main character. Liam wasn't even a main character at that time. He was one of the side characters. So I would do flashbacks to his past, and then those were really great scenes, and I knew they were great scenes, and they felt wonderful. But I felt horrible because I'm not Irish, and I didn't feel I had a right to write about all this. But I kept doing it anyway. But I kept it to a bare minimum, so it was only at that time about a third of the novel was set in the 1970s. In Northern Ireland. But I did like an astronomical amount of research just to be able to do that much. And I remember I happened to run into Elizabeth Moon, who doesn't live too far away from me. And she and I sat down and she gave me some wonderful advice, because I said, I just felt so guilty writing about this, the troubles. I was like, I don't understand why this story picked me, because I really kind of feel like stories pick authors. We don't pick stories. This one, I kept telling it to go away, and it wouldn't do it. So I had to write it. So I was just telling her, I just felt so guilty about doing this, and I didn't have a right to this. And she said, "Do you love the story?" And I said, "Yes, I do. I really do." And she said, You know that saying, write what you know? It really isn't write what you know, it's write what you love. Because you can't know something unless you love it. Not, you can't really, really know something unless you love it. So that's sort of, she kind of gave me permission, which is, I guess, silly to need permission to do it, but there you are. So I went ahead and I finished that version of the novel. And then by that point in time, I was taking Irish language lessons online. And through the Irish language school, through one of the students, her name was Kathleen, I got up the nerve finally, because of Elizabeth Moon, I finally got up the nerve to say online, because there are Irish students taking Irish language lessons online in this school. And I just said, you know, I'm writing this book, and if anyone has lived in Derry or Belfast during the 1970s, during the Troubles, I really do need to talk to you and interview you, and if you don't mind. And so a friend of mine, now a friend, Kathleen, who's an American of Irish descent, and she has a lot of family she's in close contact with in Derry. She put me in contact with my friend Brian, who lives in Belfast, and as it happens, lived in the exact neighborhood that Liam had already ended up in my manuscript. And it was so strange, the coincidences were just so odd and so wonderful too. So after I got to talking with Brian, and he made book recommendations and all sorts of things that he mailed me things to read. And it is, I have to say, it is very difficult to find research from a Catholic nationalist point of view, I have to say. Most of the history that is written about the Troubles has been written from the British point of view. And they say in history, the victor writes history, and that's very much the truth of the matter. There are always two sides to a story. It's not 100% one or the other. There are always two sides. And I discovered that more and more the more that I read. And by the time I finished doing that research, and I started also at the same time shopping my manuscript for an agent, and so I decided that I wanted to actually, by that time I knew a lot of published writers, and I decided to ask them their advice on who would be good for this manuscript. And I had been exchanging email with Black for, I want to say, about 6 years. We met at Book People when she had an event. I loved her, and I still do very much.
Sorry, what was the name? You dropped out for a sec.
Okay, her name is Holly Black.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. She wrote this wonderful, wonderful book called Tithe, and I just loved it. I was working in the kids section at Book People. I worked there for 6 years, and my specific chosen, everyone gets to pick their area of the bookstore that they get to be an expert in, and picked teen fiction, strangely enough. It used to be the one section nobody cared about. And I just really loved it. So I read her book, and I sold, apparently people keep up with these kinds of things. At the time I had no idea, but I hand sold 100 copies of Tithe in hardback within a very short period of time, and I had no idea that they were, that the numbers people were keeping track of that and who exactly was doing that. And so when Holly came to town, she had a dinner, and I was invited to go, and I got to meet Holly, and we hit it off, and we exchanged emails for like all that whole time, 6 years, on and off. And finally, I got up the nerve to ask Holly what she thought, who I should go to as, you know, for an agent. And she said, why don't you send me your first chapter? And I think I have somebody in mind, and I'll read that first chapter, and I'll make a decision about that. And I was like, oh, okay. So I sent it off to her. And as it happened, she had a trip to Ireland So she took my manuscript to Ireland with her to read that first chapter and came back go to Joe with it first and then ask me if it was okay for Joe to read it. And Joe loved it, and he called me, and he said, after reading that first chapter, he asked for a full, and I sent it to him, and he read the full and said, you know, the heart of this book is actually in Northern Ireland. What do you think about rewriting the whole thing so that it's all set in Northern Ireland? And for that last year, I had been thinking, as I was continuing my research, because I just found the whole subject so fascinating, and I still do, I was thinking that I was going to have to rewrite that book so it was all set in Northern Ireland during the 70s. And so I didn't hesitate. I just said yes. And he was like, well, I don't know. You're going to have to throw away a large portion of the manuscript. 66,000 words. So I just said, yes, I want to do this. I really do. This is what needs to happen with this book. So I did. And I rewrote it in 2 months. And gave him the new manuscript, and he took off with that. So that's the story, rambly story. The long, rambly story about the manuscript.
Okay, and Teresa, how about you? What was the route from, you know, your initial draft to the actual agent and publisher side of things?
Oh, okay. All right. From the draft, or from what I sent to, when I finally decided I had had my last critique and I had done as much to that novel as I possibly could, I had a list of agents that I wanted to submit to, and it was really kind of funny. I'd been stalking agents for about a year. Yeah, a year. So like I said, I read everything, man. Boy, if somebody had it on their blog, I was there. I was looking at it. And I was reading it, checking it out. And I had picked a group of agents that I wanted to try, mainly because what I was doing is I was reading things that those agents represented. I was reading books that those agents represented. And I was thinking to myself, okay, this one may like my stuff. This one probably won't care for it at all. While I was kind of testing things out, and you hear all the pains over query letters, and so Veronica was an intern with an agent, and she was, since she was interning with an agent, she had posted a thing that people who followed her on her blog could send her a query letter, and she would look at it, and she would kind of edit it from the agent's perspective. And I thought, well, that's kind of cool. So what have I got to lose? So I sent her, I think she wanted the first 10 pages and a query. So I sent her the query in the first 10 pages, and she edited it back to me. She was very, very complimentary about my writing, which I thought was just, wow, you know, maybe I can do this. So around June, I had finished the book, and in July, I started submitting. And needless to say, the major agencies, they just didn't even bother. I didn't even think I got a form rejection from mine. It was just that. It was that bad. Yeah, and so the I found out. Oh, it was on Twitter. That's what happened. And I saw Veronica said that she had she was now working for DeForio Literary Agency as a literary agent. And I thought, oh, she's not going to remember this. You know, she's probably got oodles of people sending her stuff. So I thought, but it can't hurt to try. So I sent her the manuscript. And at the same time, another agent was looking at it. And the other agent declined. And I had talked with Veronica on the phone. And, I mean, man, we just clicked. I mean, she almost had me ready to buy my own book. And I thought, She told me about this great book and everything, and I'm going, wait a minute, this is my book. Okay. She just loved it. She really did. And after we signed everything and signed all the papers and everything, she said she still loved it, but I needed to add about 10,000 words and do something with that kid. You know? And I'm going to tell you, that kid, I hate that kid, okay? 12-year-old kid that is in that book, I hate her with a passion. I'll do something gruesome to her before it's over with, you what? I'm so far removed from 12 years old, and it really bothers me that some people have picked it up and said, oh, look, it's a young adult. No.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, I just want to stand beside him and go, don't read that. So, anyway, though, we did. We wound up adding probably about 10,000 words to it. Because, I mean, all the things she recommended that I change, I really think she had a good vision. She saw what I was trying to do with Miss Rary, and I think that for me was so important, was that with the agent client contact, is to have an agent that has the same vision as you have for a lot of your work.
Oh, and absolutely.
She did. She was just dead on it, because I asked her, I said, you know, well, she had even mentioned at one point that we would just send it out in small batches. She said if it looked like the religion was going to get to be a problem, she said it wouldn't take much to turn this into a third world fantasy. And it wouldn't have, you know, and I probably could have done it that way, and I probably should have done it that way if you want to look at it 10,000 different ways. But it wasn't my vision for the whole series and for world, and I think it would have you know, taken, for me anyway, it would have taken something from some of the ritual and some of the future conflict that they're going to have, because it's not a utopia. And I mean, in my mind, I just want to explore how in the hell we could all sit down together and just get along. What is it do we have to put aside to get to that point? So, and that's what I really want to explore with the whole series, but through the characters. But and Veronica saw that, you know, and I think that was really important. So she sent it out, and it was on submission for 6 weeks, and Jeremy snapped it up. He just really liked it. And he had me add, I think, another 10,000 words to it. I'm a very sparse writer. I just, you know, I was just trying so hard to stay so focused, and I just forgot that, you know, so many fantasies really do kind of sprawl out. But he did. He told me it's okay. And he says, and you need to explain this more here, and you need to do this here, and people are going to wonder why this is happening. And he's really focused on the market, and he knows this market. And I trusted him, and I'm glad I did. I think all the changes he asked me to make were just dead on. And by the time the finished product with it, I was just really, really happy with it. And it took about 6 weeks. And then after that, you know, things just happen so fast.
It's funny that way.
Yeah. So... but that was it. And but it was a long, it was, for me, it's like writing the novels, you know. I probably spent more time on the preliminary work than I did on the actual submitting it and getting it out. And then when I did that, and when Veronica submitted it, it went very quickly because of those things. And that's why I usually put most of my work on the front end of my novel with research, and mainly research and character biographies and this kind of thing. I've got to know these people. It's almost like character acting, you know.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that.
Yeah, get into their heads. So, but that was it. And man, it's been fast.
So I wanted to ask about one thing that you touched on, Teresa. Amazon Book Scan, author's best friend, author's worst enemy.
Amazon, best friend, worst enemy. Okay, I'll take Amazon on. Because
you're brave.
I'm going to preface this with, I'm one of the reasons that Amazon is where it is, because when I first discovered Amazon.com, I like to have clapped myself. Here are all these wonderful, obscure, weird research books that I've been dying to have. I mean, I have a book on Slavic vampirism, for heaven's sakes, that I could not find anywhere else. I thought, God, this place rocks. I mean, my credit card was almost maxed out from Amazon.com. Yeah, all those years. And because I live in a rural county with no bookstore, I kid you not. Okay, there is that Christian bookstore, but my daughter likes to tease me and says, why don't you go down and see if they'll carry it, Mom? I say, yeah, they'll be burning it this podcast. No, but so I was just really into Amazon, and then the convenience of it. It was just like, wow, they deliver it to my post office, which my husband, who deserves a gold star and a medal and everything else, I'm putting up with the writer wife. He likes to go to the post office and tell him, I don't know why you keep bringing her books. She can't read. So the guys at the post office just think it's fabulous. So I really put a lot of money into Amazon a long time ago. And then recently I've been reading about their business practices, and I haven't been happy with them. I haven't been happy with the way they're trying to basically become a version of Walmart, where they drive all the competition out so that you have no choice but to shop with them. And I don't think that is good. I don't think monopolies are good in any capacity. Okay,
I'm not
picking on Amazon here. And they are content-driven, which means they're looking at how much they can amass, not the quality of it. And there's a big difference between those two things. And their focus is on having lots of stuff. And then when you realize they're putting their books on as a loss leader, that tells me they're not going to a lot of trouble to promote my book or your book or anybody's book.
Yeah,
they're
publishing
out to promote
is not
Amazon.
And yeah, their publishing is needed. Not their yeah. primary thing.
And who was it? Was it IBG? Was that the acronym? There was somebody today that they would not renew the contract with. And trying to remember, it was the independent, it was Abby, independent booksellers, and they would not renew the contract with them, and they pulled all those books off of Amazon. So over the last 3-4 years, I switched over to Barnes & Noble. Sometimes I can find stuff cheaper on Barnes & Noble than I can on Amazon, and I get the same convenience. I can order it from the website. They'll deliver it to my post office box. Sometimes I pay a little more. But here's the other thing, and this is very important to me, especially living in the area that I live in North Carolina, being in the way it is right now, is Amazon, when it pulls jobs and pulls affiliates to move out of state so it doesn't have to pay taxes, tells me it's not a good corporate partner.
Nope.
Barnes & Noble is here providing jobs, which are scarce, very scarce, and Barnes & Noble is paying its taxes. So for me,
that's
how I put my choice on Amazon. It goes, to me, way beyond author publisher thing. It's like an octopus. It just goes out all over, and it's just such an economic factor. I try and think I think of it that way because I'm old now. But anyway, that's Those are my thoughts on Amazon. I don't think they're an author's friend. I think they're using us like a bunch of $10 whores, and as soon as they're done with authors and can milk us for everything they can milk us, they'll treat us like dirt. I guarantee you that. That's kind of a pessimistic view, but
that's me. Yeah, I feel like Amazon is. Did you ever see the film Heathers?
Yes.
Yes, Amazon is a heather, and right now it has the scrunchie.
Yeah.
It's not really your friend. They don't really care about publishing. They don't really care about books. All they care about is money. They don't care about the authors. They just care about themselves and if how much they can get out of you. And subsequently, I really feel that while there's certain aspects of Amazon that are good and handy, there are many, many more that far outweigh it the other way, to the negative side of things, because they want so badly to be a monopoly and to go as far as to try to influence the market away from any other variety of product. For example, Amazon is actually the source for that rumor that ebooks were going to take over and replace print absolutely. They were the ones that decided, because at the time when that rumor started, they had a majority of the ebook business and they wanted to have absolute power over it. And you know what they say about absolute power? It corrupts absolutely.
But have either of you managed to avoid looking at your Amazon sales rankings?
No, I look at it constantly. Yeah. So, I mean, it just, once in a while, for like a couple of weeks, I can step off and convince myself that I don't need to know and I don't need to look at it. And then something will happen and then I look at it again. And then once again, I'm looking at it every day. It's something that is a curse and a blessing. just like having the ability for anyone to post a review of your work is a curse and a blessing. Because sometimes people are odd. Sometimes people lose sight of the fact that it's a big old world and there are all sorts of people in it, and not everything is designed for you personally, and that's okay. People lose sight of that. They really do. They forget that there are plenty of other people who disagree with them, and they have different tastes, and a book that is not for you may be for somebody else, and that's all right. If we were all exactly the same, this world would be such a boring place. It really would. So, I mean, people just tend to forget that. I mean, reviewers, real reviewers, don't forget that. Professional reviewers understand that quite well. But
I like to think so.
yes, absolutely. And Karen, you know.
I got to say something about the Amazon reviews now, because Miserere doesn't have that many, which is okay with me after I've read a few of them. I have a couple that just make me laugh. And I mean, I really hope they never take them down, because when I'm really feeling down, I like to go and read them, because I get a giggle out of them every time. It's like, I'm bored.
Yeah.
Were you and I reading the same book? But, you know, it's not so much, and I mean, you know, you Goodreads is another one that's fun to read sometimes.
Oh, absolutely.
I like to take the Mark Lawrence view of the whole thing and just take it all rather tongue in cheek and have some fun with it, because at some point, if you don't, I mean, you just implode. I can't take the reviews and I can't take myself too seriously in all this, because I do it to have fun. Believe it or not, all this stress. I'm trying to think of how that works. But I do it to have fun. I do it that I enjoy. Yeah, and but now the Amazon and the rankings and the reviews and everything. I mean, it's just it's sometimes it's just like it's insanity. But the ebook thing, that was what you were talking about, Shana, and that was something, something that I wanted to talk about too, is everybody saying ebooks are going to take over print. And I stop and I think, another author put it on her blog, and I wish to heavens I had written her name down, because she made some very, very valid points. She had talked about when she was young and she could not afford a lot, they would go to the library and they would get books, and those books were her world. And it's the same way here, and I guess a lot of people live in metropolitan areas, and they don't think about rural areas like where I live. And I'm going to tell you what, right? Yeah, you're not going to see an e-reader or an iPad in everybody's hand.
You're really not. Not everybody can afford it. It's classism to decide absolutely that one format will absolutely take over everything. It's classism. They completely forget about people who can't afford these things, and I know I'm one of them. I can't afford the most up-to-date technology all the time. I certainly don't even own an e-reader. Yeah. So it's I feel,
and not when they're checking something new out. I mean, every year, what, you got the iPad 3 coming out, and everybody's going, didn't you get an iPad? Why? I let all you rubes work through all the problems with it. I don't buy one until they're into the fourth or fifth version, you know.
And you think about, there are so many other things to think about as well when it comes to ebooks. I mean, when your personal library is your personal library. I don't know about you, but I am very protective of my library. I had an ex-boyfriend who just didn't understand, why do you carry around all these, why do you have all these books? And it's a personal library. That information is really important to me. Reading is really important to me. So I get very angry when people try to take books away from me. And the 800-pound gorilla in the room took away books from people five different times in the first year that ebooks were out. Five different times. Didn't tell them that they had taken them out of their libraries. Customers found out on their own. They weren't informed of it, and they weren't refunded the money either. And one of those books was 1984. So, I mean, and being a science fiction fantasy author, I look ahead a little bit and think, How much further do they have to go until they begin to change the content of those books?
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
I remember the 1984 flap, yeah. But, you know, I work in a library, okay? And I'm going to tell you, right now, I work in a library, work in a community college library in a, you know, very rural area. We've got people who don't have even a computer in their house, okay? They come to the library to use ours, and we do spend a lot of time teaching people how to use stuff, you know, and I'm sure it's even more so in the public library, public libraries in town. And so these people just don't have access to that kind of thing. And even with a $99 Kindle, I mean, you're talking about something that that's going to be there as long as it lasts, and how long do electronics last? And this, from a library's perspective, I will just give you a longevity. Paper can last in upwards of 1,000 years. Digital is 5 years, a lifespan.
Absolutely.
5 years. But yeah, because the format changes, and you have to keep changing that format to stay up to date with what's new.
And how many times are you going to be willing to rebuy your library? I mean, we all do it with DVDs as it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and with, the DVD. Yeah, the DVD. Let me tell you about DVDs. The lifespan of a DVD is supposed to be 5 years. The lifespan of a real DVD is probably about 3 checkouts, okay?
Oh, really?
I mean, Yeah, they do not stand up to any kind of abuse. The same thing with the digital device. I have a Nook, and I love my Nook when I travel, because then I can carry probably about 8 or 10 different things on it. And sometimes I take it with me and read it, and most of the time I leave it at home and I take a book. And there's two reasons for that. One, on my Nook, I tend to flip back and forth between things. I can't hold my attention span long enough to read through something because I feel like I'm on a computer and I feel like I ought to be flipping around. With a book, I have it there, it's in my hand, and it's what I focus on. The other thing is I put on my Nook, because I'll put paperbacks on my Nook. I'll buy, you know, something that I'm going to read once and probably never read again. But my research books, and man, I put some money into these puppies. Mm. I buy them hardbound because I can't do research from a computer. I always have to print it out. Maybe it's because I'm old. I don't know. It could be any number of things. But I can't focus on it. I can't highlight it. I can't work with the document the same way online that I do in paper. But going back to the other, I think it's very important that we remember that if we're going to educate people and if we're going to give people something enduring and something lasting, we can't move completely to electronic. We have to have some form of paper. And books and learning and literature, to me, are our heritage as a society, of what we're leaving behind. And yeah, we're going to leave some crap behind, but we're also going to leave some very, very significant good works. So you want them to last 1,000 years, you want them to last 5.
Right. Exactly. And I always think about, you know, we're science fiction writers, so I think of the zombie apocalypse. What happens to e-readers when there's a zombie apocalypse? I mean, come on! But yeah, I mean, I like all of it. I think it's great that some people do so well with ebooks, and I think it's wonderful because we actually get more readers as a result of that. You know, if that is your preferred method of go you, have at it. But I think all of it should exist. I think all of it is necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. The more formats, the merrier. That's kind of my my philosophy.
That's totally mine.
Now, there was one other thing I wanted to touch on before I let you guys go. Teresa, I know you said that you still have your day job. Stina, do you still have a day job?
No, my day job left me.
Oh, okay. So one of my questions was, for both of you, Stina being able to write full-time and Teresa having to fit writing around work, I don't know, Stina, have you found that to be helpful or just another source of stress or?
I'm lucky because I have a husband who now can support me.
Yeah, and especially in Texas, that's a little easier than other parts of the country, I have to say.
Yes, it is. But these days, that's pretty much a rarity. Mm-hmm. But I am very lucky. So my husband supports me. So I do not have to worry quite so much about bills and so forth. I just worry about, you know, getting myself to the conventions and doing the appropriate promotional work, getting bookmarks made and that kind of thing. He cannot afford to do. But so that all of that comes out of my book money. But is it more stressful? It is and it isn't. I mean, in a way, I mean, I set my own schedule and all that stuff, and everybody thinks that's ideal. One day I will quit my job and I will become a full-time writer. Mm-hmm. And then, yes, of course, you have the freedom of writing whenever you need to, but then that's the thing. You also have the freedom to check out the internet for hours at a time or do all these other things when you should be writing. So it makes it a little harder to focus, I think, in a lot of ways. When you have a set schedule and you know that you have only 2 hours to write, you write in those 2 hours. Mm-hmm. You do not twiddle your thumbs and surf the internet. You just don't. So it's got its up bonuses and it's not so great. It's just how it is all around. Rosanna Dana used to have a saying from Saturday Night Live, you know, it's always something.
True that. And Teresa, how about for you? Does that take some of the stress off of, for instance, selling the novel, or does it just frustrate you that, you know, gosh, you have so little time to write?
It was a full-time job. I love my job. I'm just going to say that first off. My job is so cool because I work with books every day. So
that's
and,
awesome.
And because it's a community college library, it really helps me that I've got all these wonderful resources at my fingertips that I can use. The people that I meet keep, I don't know. To me, I found that when I take a week off and I do nothing but write, after a period of time, I start to stagnate. So I really need that people factor. And it gets my mind
yes.
off of the writing enough so that I'm focused on my job. But every now and then, I just get this little blip of an idea. You know, and I just take it and I keep a little piece of paper with me and I jot down the idea and stick it in my bag and move on to the next thing. But for some reason, it just being able to focus on something other than the novel helps me to focus on it better. I don't really know how to explain that. It's just the way my strange ADD brain works. It's just driving to work in the morning. I put on my soundtrack and I listen to it as I'm going in and jot down whatever ideas I have safely once I have stopped the vehicle in the parking lot. You know, and that's always so nice to be able to do that. And then to be able to talk to other people and it doesn't really give me ideas for characters, but it gives me ideas of interactions because I'm just fascinated
oh, yeah.
by the way people interact. Yeah,
absolutely.
And, I don't know. It just really helps inspire me sometimes. And then there's other times when I feel like I'm so stressed, my hair is going to start falling out. But I thrive on that kind of thing. When there's nothing going on around me, I'm just. It's like my brain shuts down. So
yeah.
I'll probably do some more of that.
Yeah, I think I'm a weird combination of introvert, extrovert. I'm not one or the other. I'm kind of both. I need people interaction pretty badly. This last weekend, I was at ConDFW, and I had to laugh because it was like looking in a mirror. Sherry Priest was there, and she was like, oh my gosh, every 15 minutes, oh my gosh, people! And that's kind of the downside, because you are by yourself all day long.
Well, on that note, we should probably start to wrap things up, so I did want to thank you both very much for coming on. And I wanted to give you both a chance to talk about anything that you have upcoming. So, Teresa, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you might have coming out or maybe the work in progress that you're working on, if you feel free?
Upcoming. Well, I'm going to try, since it's the podcast and it'll be on for a while, upcoming, I'm going to be going to cons this year. That's something that always excites me. I love that.
Oh, excellent.
My current work in progress, I'm just finally getting really immersed in, and I'm working through the second draft of it and fine-tuning it and coming up with some things for it, and it's set on the Iberian Peninsula. It's more of a historical fantasy than Miserere is. So it just makes it really, I just love history. So I'm just really into that. And it's just been a very, very busy, great year. But I'm looking forward to getting out there. And I'm really looking forward to being at ChiCon this year. That's going to be a first for me. I'm going to Chicago to that. And I'm just so totally just wired.
Oh, excellent.
It's
going to
be really exciting. And thank you. Yes, thank you, Karen, so much for doing this. I really appreciate the opportunity. I do want to say that.
Oh, I'm glad to. And Stina, I know the sequel to Of Blood and Honey is coming out.
Absolutely, yes. It's called And Blue Skies from Pain, which is kind of a Pink Floyd reference. Yes, it comes out, I guess Amazon says March 1st now, but the official date is March 20th. So there's that. And I'm working on, and I also, like Teresa, have a thing about history. So right now I'm working on a YA actually right now that is set in my own fantasy world, but the technology is all late 1700s. So I'm having fun researching that era, reading about early American history, and playing around with that. So that's what I'm working on right now. And I also kind of hope to make it to Worldcon. That Chicago would be such a hoot. And I haven't got to meet Teresa, so I really want to do that.
Well, I know I will definitely be at ShyCon. My tickets are secure. Even Gavin has a little kid in tow registration, so I think hopefully with any luck I'll see you both there.
Oh, terrific. That'll be wonderful. Thank you so much for doing this.
No problem. Okay, well, thank you very much, and I will talk to you later.
All right. Bye.